From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway for this week in midwinter. There are no low roses blooming nor anything else under the snow. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with my colleagues, Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette.
Hey, good to be here.
Hey, great to see you. Ira Fesfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston.
Hello, Judy and Rex and Alan. Good to hear you.
Wonderful to see you. And the aforementioned Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. You down there, Alan?
I'm here.
He's there. He's over in the Berkshires, actually, in here by tie line. We're very glad to have you, Alan. So whenever you want to speak, you just put up your hand, and when I see you, I'll recognize you.
Which is never.
Oh, yes. Is that right? Well.
I get it, Rex.
Okay. Just want to make sure. By the way, we do have a little note from a listener, George, and we always welcome notes. He says, Trump attacks good journalism, and the Media Project defends the media. He says, the media as an institution being rather indefensible, maybe you should limit your defense to good journalism. I get that. I don't understand that we're defending the media, although I mean, some of us actually work in imperiled industries, right? So I guess we're kind of defending that.
Yeah, but we've made this point again and again and again that all media is not the same. I mean, if we were always just talking about the media, George would have a point. But you and all of your colleagues, Rex, have made the point that there is the New York Post and there's the New York Times.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And there's Fox News and there's the local television news station.
Exactly.
But you know what? We'll even defend bad media because there is a First Amendment and bad media has the right to be bad and they have the right to be criticized by those of us who think they ought to be criticized. But the concern that many of us have with this current administration is that they're not only complaining about the media in the traditional way, but they're essentially suggesting we shouldn't even exist because we're the enemy of the people. And when they're talking about it like that, we're all in the same boat. We will defend ourselves.
Good
well, you make a good point, Ira, but you also make a bad point. And here's what I'm thinking, that every time we don't do our jobs correctly, and Rex is always, somewhat pompously, but always suggested that if you make mistakes, you leave yourself open in the court of public opinion. And so therefore, Ira, I don't think it's okay to just defend the media if the media does something that's wrong, because it's hurtful to everybody.
I wouldn't want to defend a media organization by saying they're all accurate. They're not all accurate. Some are less accurate than others. And most, when they are inaccurate, will correct their mistakes. You tell me, Alan, the next time you hear a big-time or small-time politician who makes an error come up to the microphone the next day and say, I made an error, whereas newspapers and broadcast will immediately correct a mistake once they're made aware of the mistake.
So, Ari, you've never seen a time when the media makes a mistake and doesn't step up to the microphone the next day, because I sure have.
I can't speak for every media organization in the world, but
yes,
the most of the respectable ones correct their mistakes immediately.
Yeah, that's true, but not that you're right. There remains debate now, even about the role of the mainstream media in the lead up to the Iraq War. Was enough done? There is internal criticism of the New York Times for its credulous reporting about weapons of mass destruction and so on. But that is addressed and talked about, and we're quite open about dealing with it, I think. And in our own case, you know, I mean, every day we look at what we put out. I don't know, I kind of didn't like my paper today very much.
I used to have those days.
Oh, man. Some days, you know, you look at the front page and say, you know, I really don't want to go any further. This is not good. So there are days, and then there are days. So.
But the good thing is that you can then take a deep breath and get going on the next day's paper and have a chance to redeem yourself immediately.
Yep. By the way, speaking of all different kinds of the media, we ought to take a little moment to talk about this hot new book by Michael Wolff, who was the longtime media writer at New York Magazine, a guy with a long 40-year background in journalism of a different sort than what we practice. But Michael Wolff's book, which everybody in Washington is talking about, we can't really deal with the substance of his book about the Trump White House, Fire and Fury. But what he did in this is he had extraordinary access to the White House, did a lot of on-the-record conversations in the White House. He kind of gained this access thanks to the then-chief of staff, Reince Priebus, did a lot of interviews. Senior staffers would go across to the Hay Adams Hotel right across from the White House and talk to him. And now he's published this book that is creating a firestorm, indeed, leading the president to say he's going to sue him. And the president's going to sue Steve Bannon, too. Quite a remarkable situation for a journalist writing a book about an ongoing situation that is the Trump White House.
Right. He said he had more than 200 interviews to do this book, many of them on the record, some of them off the record.
Right. And it does show you some of the things that you can do if you have the right access. Very few people would be able to get that access, but Wolff is a guy who's, he's in his early 60s. He's been a media industry investor. He's run different operations and returned to writing after a couple of his business ventures failed. But he's the kind of a guy who, you know, oftentimes reporters need to have a certain amount of chutzpah to be able to actually execute on some of these things. And the result is we get an extraordinary inside look of what's going on in the White House in book form.
Which springs to be number one on Amazon in hours after it started to leak what was in it. And some of the Bannon quotes, which, of course, I think we should deal with, because Bannon is the guy. And the reason that it's so important to deal with him is because the president himself is now saying that the one thing that Bannon was good at was leaking to the very press that he hated so much.
Well, you know, we need to just as lay as a groundwork in order to put this in context. I'm hoping, although it doesn't make our country look good to have a portrait of the White House as it is written about in this book, but I'm hoping that it's accurate because I don't care for this White House and it will not help them long term. But what I primarily about Michael Wolff, he does not have the best reputation for accuracy. He's had problems and I believe admitted at one point making stuff up. So that gives me some reason for pause. And in the excerpt of this book that I read on the web that was in New York Magazine, I found two mistakes that I could identify, and I'm hardly an insider. So I hope the book is largely accurate, but I do have at least a question about it.
Ira, what were the mistakes?
He said that Trump did not know who John Boehner was. You know, I can't prove that that's not accurate, but I just find it incredibly that that is accurate.
Right. The Washington Post dissected that and found, I think, 15 references to John Boehner in Trump comments.
Right. And then the other one was in reference to the famous Russian dossier, which a lot of the media did not read in great detail because of some of the salacious, unproven accusations against Trump. The book said in the excerpt that CNN had reported the details of the dossier, and CNN in particular went to great lengths to point out that it did not intend to report the details of the dossier.
But that being said, Steve Bannon's not walking back any comments or any of the quotes.
No.
Right. Actually, the person who is quite a hero at the moment is whoever works for the president and put the words in his mouth. You know, as a former flack myself, I appreciate somebody who can write well. And so the president's statement about Steve Bannon saying when he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. Great quote.
Yeah,
right?
It's believed to be Kellyanne Conway.
You know, really? I didn't think Steve Bannon was fired. I thought he resigned to take on new challenges.
And going back to the accuracy of the book, Wolff says he has most of these interviews on tape, which is going to be make Rosemary Wood's tape look like a piker. And it has led to the White House to saying there will now be a ban on cell phone, personal cell phones in the West Wing.
Well, it's a great way to operate a government. It's interesting anyway to take note of it, and we will see what the fallout of it is. The Media Project, if you want to share your thoughts, by the way, we're media@wamc.org. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith here from the studios of WAMC in snowy Albany, New York. Here we are at the early in a new year. We had to talk about what's going on and what the outlook is for the new year. And I'm most intrigued by some of the thoughts that have been offered as to the big unknowns in the media in 2018. One of them came from, and I think it has relevance to, especially to our public radio listeners, Clay Shirky, who is the New York University professor, internet expert, the guy who came up with the phrase, yeah, I thought it was going to come to me, not intervening, a technology that tears things apart is called a... Anyway, Clay Shirky.
I thought Alan was going to rescue there.
Yeah, remarkable remarkable thinker.
I should know this because Clay Shirky was a close confidant of my former CEO. I don't know the...
So he says that this year, the 2018, he thinks, will be the perfect test case for user-supported media. And that is, ad-supported media has long reigned. Newspapers, you know, used to get 75% of their revenue from advertising. But now newspapers are about to begin the 49th consecutive quarter of year-over-year revenue declines. And so the question is, will we get more user support? Public radio, of course, has always turned to listeners and said, please give us money to keep this going. And that has worked for public radio, right? By and large, Alan, like, what percentage comes from donations?
About half comes from donations. About half comes from the underwriting that occurs on WAMC.
Right.
But the interesting thing is he or she who gets there first often sets the path. Now, what I mean by that is we recently had a real opportunity to buy a tower on the top of Mount Greylock. We had always been on it. But if we were kicked off of it, because our friends at Channel 10 in Albany owned it, if we were kicked off of it, if they sold it to somebody else, we would not have an audience anymore. It's that simple. We just wouldn't have an audience. And without anything, people have kicked in. By the time people hear this broadcast, we'll be at about $1 million without really having worked at it. So all I'm saying, Rex, is it's because people are used to it. They know it. They know it's theirs. And it's a shared ownership. As opposed to newspapers, which are owned.
Yeah.
Get it?
Yeah. Well, Clay Shirky has said, is the internet runs on love, to describe the nature of collaboration. He speaks in favor of crowdsourcing and collaborative efforts to create content, but then also to actually support journalism. And the question is, how do you support journalism if advertising is no longer there? And again, remember, just it's simple economics. There's an abundance of advertising. There's an unlimited inventory of advertising available on the internet. So that drives down the price. And that means that there isn't as much money to support internet-based information providers, which is what newspapers increasingly have to become, as radio stations do, as they all do. And so you have to find another way to support it. And the question is, there are only two ways. One is to ask listeners, readers, viewers to give. And the other is, perhaps, to see if there are good local people, like the folks who bought the Berkshire Eagle out in the Berkshires, who will take a very tiny profit margin or perhaps none at all to support local journalism in their community.
Well, here's what we know. The New York Times claims to now have a paid digital subscriber total of 3.5 million. I dare say the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal are doing fairly well on that end of the business as well. Nobody, including the big guys, is doing as well as they used to in print advertising, to be sure. And I believe digital advertising has largely been a disappointment, although there's more of it than there was at one time. The question that I have as a retired community newspaper editor is, I don't know that there is enough business, circulation business, to sustain long term, even if it was dramatically increased, the paid digital list. Whereas the New York Timeses of the world are able to report on a story like the White House, which is the story of our time, and add people and resources to cover it. The local newspapers are already depleted because of the financial condition of the operations, and they can't provide the kind of detail that will sell more digital subscriptions.
So here's my question to you, Ira, and to Rex, and to everybody who knows the business, because for years I've been saying, well, poor everybody, that they're going to go out of business. And in fact, Rex has said 10 years from now, there won't be any more newspapers or most.
Print.
Did not say that. No, sir. I said
I could
that.
Swear I heard that.
No. That there will be a lot of print publications that will go out of business, but I think that the dominant media organizations in most communities will remain those that used to publish print newspapers in their
communities. Okay, so you changed your mind. Okay, so my question.
Did he raise his hand to?
I don't think so.
Okay. So my question to all of you is, hypocrisy aside, no matter what, are you still making money?
Well, what? Yeah, sure. Aren't you?
I'm not making any personal money. No, I'm making a salary. But I'm asking, look, there's no...
But you don't operate at a loss. You figured out a way to make that.
There's no need to get testy here.
No. I'm just pointing out that media organizations can't be expected to operate at a loss, whether they're public media or privately held.
No, but my point is that, you know, I'm hearing a lot of crocodile tears on the show over and over again about how bad things are. But
no, these are real tears, Alan. Real tears.
But these newspapers are still making money. Is it your shooting? Is it the Schenectady paper making money now?
So what we've had to do is transform how we operate to become more efficient, and then that will have some inevitable impacts on what we do and how we do it. It means we don't have as many reporters that have met as many town and village board meetings. We don't have as many reporters at school board meetings. We can't be in as many courts as we'd like to be. So that does impact what we do. But, I mean, no business can stay in business for long without making money.
Yeah, and some newspapers, such as the one that my favorite newspaper that I worked for 45 years, have done things like close our press rooms and mail rooms and laid off scores of people, which saves money so they can continue to make some sort of profit. But it also, in our case, weakens the product because we go on the press at Rex's fine newspaper earlier in the evening than we did when we were publishing on our own press, thus weakening the morning's news report. So there's a cause and effect. Sure, we want, if we start losing money, and I say we, I haven't looked at our P&Ls in almost 4 years, but if we start losing money, the paper is not going to stay in existence because we're not going to throw money away.
And here's the real effect of it, too. Let's take not just New York, let's take the state of Illinois. A few years ago, there were more than 30 full-time reporters covering the Illinois legislature, according to a woman named Madeline Dubeck, who's for the Chicago Better Government Association. So from 30 full-time reporters covering the Illinois legislature, that number is now down to 4. One for the AP, one for the Chicago Tribune, one for Gatehouse, and one called Capital Facts. So, you know, we're lucky in New York that we still have a thriving press corps in the state capitol, but the result is if you are a citizen of the state of Illinois, you know a lot less about state government in a state that arguably has the worst record of political corruption. Something like 4 out of the last 5 governors have gone into federal prison.
Well, I talked to somebody who's
Illinois.
I talked to somebody who's active on a local town board in my area, who says that there are often no reporters and nobody from the public at their meetings. So how is that good for democracy when there's nobody there to watch what people are doing?
Right, and you hear people say that, oh, the citizens bloggers are going to step forth and cover the governments for us, but that's not true. You're not going to get anyone other than a professional journalist out on a night like tonight in the middle of January when the wind is blowing to sit through the town board meeting and sift through what's important and what's not.
And what happens, you know, we used to dream of this. Citizen reporters would rise up and it would give voice to this. And oh my goodness, what a concept. Everybody wants to write their opinion. People just want to write their essays. People do not realize that serious journalism, even just simple reporting on town boards, as Judy's saying, and that kind of stuff, requires standards, and it's not as easy as it looks. I used to have this fantasy that our reporters were going to become beat managers, and they would have little clusters of Judy smiling knowingly. Yes, this is an editor's fantasy. That they would have people kind of reporting to them, and that doesn't happen. We created this huge blogger network at the Times Union on timesunion.com with 150 bloggers, and most of them have tiny audiences, those that remain, and they're all writing their opinions and talking about what is of interest to them.
And they don't update very often.
Yeah, but I live in the greatest town, according to the Smithsonian Magazine, small town in America, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And one of the interesting things is a remarkable woman named Eileen Mooney has stepped forward and for years gone to every board meeting, Board of Selectmen meeting and others, and writes a little thing every day about everything that's going on. And she's an excellent journalist. And so in some cases, your fantasies have proven right.
Where does her work appear?
She sends out a newsletter.
Oh.
And you buy it for $15 or something like that. I'm not sure.
You mean digital newsletter?
No. It's a newsletter. It gets put into the mail, and
she pays for it to get mailed.
I'm not sure. I'll be honest with you. I know my wife gets it.
Are there advertisements in it?
No, I.
Oh,
don't
so this is a this is a
hobby.
Labor of love. Yeah. This is a citizen.
Very rare.
This is a hobbyist, and that's great. But you can't.
Well,
depend
is that somewhat snottily dismissive?
No, it's wonderful.
Rex, as a hobbyist, I mean, come on, we can do better than that.
Well, I would like to see some of the investigative reporting that we're talking about. I'd like to see some of the watchdog work and see how she responds when people slam doors in her face after she... I don't mean to disparage this woman herself, but...
She's
I'm
tough.
Just, good. I'm glad. I think it's terrific, but I don't think that that's the answer for journalism in this country.
Well,
I don't
it's one
think
answer.
That will work. Okay, it's one answer. I'm glad it works in Great Barrington. And if
the
this
greatest
radio
small town in America.
you know, this professor from the University of New Hampshire has a really interesting idea, and that was the fact that we need to educate America so they take real journalism more seriously. She uses the metaphor of putting us on a healthier diet, a healthier news diet, so we don't just want to read about the Kardashians or whoever else is hip right now that I may not know about.
Exactly.
In my case, that's almost everybody.
Yeah, right. Actually, Clay Shirky, the previously mentioned, wrote a book about media diet, which is a wonderful phrase. And if we could teach people to be better consumers of the media, that would be a good thing. That's news literacy. Can we talk about my favorite topic? Oh, well, what can you do? So the year ahead is likely to give us still the Trump perpetual campaign against the press. His ongoing Twitter feed that is definitely going to have a continuing impact, isn't it?
He's having his big awards ceremony in the next couple of days.
Ah, right.
He's giving away his awards for the most fake and dishonest media. I mean, can you imagine that this is what the President of the United States is doing when he's not being distracted by the Bannon book or the Wolf book, and when he's not out there playing golf, and when he's not paying attention to his crazy tweets with North Korea? He's got time to give these awards out. It's nonsense. It's embarrassing. It's an insult. And I've run out of adjectives.
But then, we've got the state media, that is Fox News, who supports all of this.
Yes,
and if people have a steady diet of only Fox News, they do not have a sense of any questions about this because it's just all reinforcing him.
Look, the guy got himself elected president of the United States. I'm still wavering between all the things Ira just said and say, OK, this guy's a nutcase. And I know I'll get letters on that, and I apologize. You're not supposed to call anybody nuts. But this guy's a nutcase, or or the other side of that is he's an evil genius.
Well, that's Michael Moore's phrase. He's an evil genius.
Yeah. I don't know who said it first, Ira, me or Michael Moore. I suspect it was me. What can I tell you?
It was after you invented the turtle for Mitch McConnell.
Right. That's right.
Yes.
That's absolutely correct.
Yes.
But some people come to the same things from different paths. So... all I'm going to tell you is it may be that he is the king of distraction, so that when he's doing the kinds of stuff that he's doing, and this is the question that good political scientists and others will be discussing for years, is does he know what he's doing, or is he just a nut?
Well, as we near the end here, I just want to point out that the spreadsheet analysis done by an NYU graduate student of Trump's anti-Trump tweets have found 990 tweets since he first ran his campaign against the press, which is, by the way, more than the number of goals Wayne Gretzky scored in his NHL career. And of those 990 tweets, Jonathan Peters in Columbia Journalism Review says they show the terrible depth of Trump's anti-democratic depravity and his willingness to scathe any journalist or news organization in his way. So on that cheery note, we need to end the media project for the day. Alan, you can go back to your orange juice and post toasties. There you are. That's very good. Thank you.
And Rex, if I've said anything to offend anybody on the panel, I do want to apologize.
Yeah, yeah. He wants to embrace anything he said.
What does he mean, if?
Ira Fussfeld from the Daily Freeman, long time. Judy Patrick from the Daily Gazette. And I'm Rex Smith in the Times Union. Thanks for joining us on the Media Project.
To get a living wage, they joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained.
Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.